I'm frustrated about crypto because it feels obvious to me that it makes sense. I think it's obvious that it's the greatest way to put capital together ever.
Hey, podcast listener. Even if you are alone in your entrepreneurial journey, know that today, right now in your earbuds, you are joined by thousands of entrepreneurs from all around the globe seeking to grow better, more profitable, location-independent businesses. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and download our entire back catalog, check out tropicalmba.com.
Happy Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Tropical MBA Podcast. What's going on, boss man?
I was going to say the title of my book just now, but I'm going to save it. Because it's relevant to what you just asked, but I'll save it.
All right. The setup is, if Ian were to write a biography with a ghostwriter, what would the title be? We're going to reveal in just a minute. Today's guest is someone I would read a biography of. He recently raised $18 million. That is not a typo. I had to Google it after the interview just to double check, because that was, I don't know, $18 million. That's a lot of dollars. His company, Rally, helps e-commerce merchants kick ass online. Their current H1 is turn your checkout into a sales machine instantly. Jordan helped us turn our e-commerce company into a sales machine. Something I learned in the interview is we were the third customer of his previous startup, which he exited. It was called Carthook, and he reached $6 million of annual recurring revenue before Shopify got involved. We'll tell a little bit of that story, and he exited that business. So Jordan's got some incredible experience. Ian, do you remember being the third customer of Carthook? We had to move those portable bars at the time. We were looking for solutions.
I remember using Carthook. And I don't remember how we like ended up on the phone, but I remember him pitching me on investing in that company early days. And then me hanging up the phone and being like, I'm too poor to invest in anything except for lunch down the street. So, but I don't think I told Jordan that at the time. I thought it was like pretty cool that I got asked, but then I was like, I don't have any money. How am I going to do that?
It's like, thank you for thinking I have enough money to invest in your company, and I will evaluate it in light of all the other incredible capital opportunities on my end. It's like one capital opportunity is to pay my rent and not get kicked out of my house, and then the other opportunity is to invest in Carthook. We all know we made a big mistake. We wouldn't make it again.
I just want to say, too, Jordan was the first customer at Remote First Recruiting.
That's right.
We had launched Dynamite Jobs. It was during COVID. We had built a job board, and Jordan approached us. He's like, man, this is cool, but can you just do this for me? He's like, I don't have time, man. I'm raising $18 million. We're like, that's an interesting idea. So he was our anchor client for Remote First Recruiting.
I asked our team about Jordan and his team, and they were like, they're straight G's. They are so professional. We've actually learned a great deal from Rally and the way they operate. And that's why Jordan's on the show today. I asked Jordan about so many things, why nobody is talking about crypto right now, even though it's at an all-time high, but the landscape's certainly different. We're going to talk about the Shopify ecosystem and the situation for e-commerce merchants in 2024. We're going to talk about partnerships and something I like to call the pervasive veto effect. Should you partner or not? Jordan has a ton of experience with this, and also taking risks with other people's money. How fast should you demand your capital return to you? And how does that calculus change whether you're using your own money, you're bootstrapping, or whether you're raising money?
I just want to make sure that everybody, including Jordan, understands this, but I did not get a call about investing in Rally. May have been based on my rejection of his first startup, but I am a little hurt about that.
And then one final thing to look forward to in the interview is I actually had Jordan fire me live.
I've been trying to do that for years. I got to call Jordan and figure out how I did that.
I was like, do it, man. Fire me right now. All right. Some news at the top. I just want to shout out to the listener that won our scholarship to our event in Mexico in Playa del Carmen in May. His name is Thomas. I'm looking forward to meeting him down in Mexico. He has accepted that free ticket and he will be joining a couple hundred founders in Playa del Carmen. Also, something we've been doing 14 times now as we give away scholarships in the DC to our events for founders who are looking for some inspiration and to take that next step in their business. So congratulations to DCer Rob Sanchez for winning that scholarship ticket this year. That includes
a 3-day ticket to the event, 4 nights at the Hyatt, round trip airfare from Alan Walton of Spy Guy, a Manta Pro sleep mask. Shout out to Mark Zhang and the good people at Manta, which is a story we featured on this show as well. And also, they will be receiving a Manal carry-on bag 2.0, the ultimate digital nomad flashpacker gear. Thanks to Jimmy and Doug from Manal for supplying all those goodies. Rob's going to be kitted up for this event in May. I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's super cool, this concept of paying it forward. We were taking a look at some of the DC membership profiles, what people are looking for in community. And one of the number one things people are looking for is to give back, whether it's through mentorship, teaching, and in this case, straight up donations and inspiration. So wanted to highlight some of those companies here today. You know, after I got off the phone with Jordan, I was inspired directly from him as a team builder. One of the things he said on the call that I kept repeating afterwards, he's like, sometimes you just got to be a gangster, of course, not in the criminal sense, but what he meant by being a G is you got to make the hard decisions. And not all of us signed up for the hard decisions. We signed up for the lifestyle. We signed up to be creative, to make a couple bucks, to one day make that investment. And now we find ourselves with successful businesses that are getting momentum. And now the hard decisions start to show up. And specifically, those decisions show up with personnel. This transition from player to coach, we know how to be players, but we don't know how to be coaches. And what is our coaching style going to be? So I started going a little deep dive. What are the ways to be a G out there? And I dug up one of the all-time Gs, a person that Fortune magazine called one of the greatest CEOs of all time. His name is Jack Welch. Jack was the CEO of General Electric for 20 years. And when he retired, he was such a G, they gave him $500 million. They were just like, thanks a lot, Jack. You were great.
By the way, I don't think anybody gave Jack anything. I think according to what I learned about Jack, he took that because he's a G.
He was like, continue. I'll leave if you give me $500 million. Thank you. That would be appropriate for my contributions. When it came time for Jack to write his memoirs, he selected the title Winning as the appropriate title. He had a boardroom of creatives around him, and he's like, there's only one option. We're going with Winning. Tells you something about Jack's personality. Ian, just as a curiosity, if you were to write a personal biography about your business career, starting with Cat Furniture, evolving through the past on the Jordan Gao investment, and nowadays as a podcaster, what would you title your book?
Thanks for the intro to my career, my life's work. I guess if I was going to have to sum it up, I'd just say pulling it together based on the way that you introduced me. I appreciate that. Look, I'm working on it. I'm pulling it together.
Here's the thing that jumps out about Jack that I read about. He has this concept called the vitality curve. And something he recognized about businesses was this idea of A players. 20% of your team is going to be the folks driving the results. 70% are going to be the ones that need to improve or evolve. 10% are going to be the team members that's holding the company back. And starting to think about methodologies for how Jack, some people say, oh, Jack's ruthless, but that's the system right there. Do you agree or disagree with the vitality curve? He's essentially taking an 80-20 principle approach to organizations. And Jack pioneered this concept, which I still hear about in tech companies all the time, which is we're going to take a look at our total team composition every single year, and we're going to move the people out who aren't a good fit. We're going to find ways to improve and change the circumstance for the vast majority of players. And we are going to empower the A players. And that's a G move. And I think it's something that is a big challenge for so many bootstrapped founders. And it's part of the reason why I went on my little Jack Welch Winning deep dive, because there's a method to the ruthlessness here. From the outside, we look at it like these things are traumatic. The worst thing, if you ask 10 founders what the worst thing they have to do is, 9 out of 10 of them are going to say firing people. Yet, Jack created a process around what he saw the necessary moves businesses and organizations need to make. You got to trade players, you got to develop a bench, you got to draft new draft picks, and you've got to emphasize the winners and move them up through the organization. The question that I brought to Jordan, and the question I think for a lot of us listening today, is what is our methodology for evolving our teams? And that's being a G. Can we talk a little bit about Jack Welch at the top here? Because I just get a sense that there's a delta between those of us at the beginning of our journeys and those of us that have managed to get through this scale phase, which is past $5 million in revenue. And that delta is almost always something you can chalk up to team composition. One of the things Jordan said in today's conversation is that the number one mistake that founders make is not firing people fast enough or effectively. It's just one little window into this challenge of whatever data point you look at, but like of the companies that go from 1 million to 10 million, the percentages aren't great. And so the question is, are we going to continue to be a creative enterprise, or are we going to take on this G challenge and figure out ways to build effective teams? Today's guest, Jordan Gao, has managed to do it. Let's hear from him now.
I'm Jordan Gao, and I run a company called Rally. Rally offers online retailers a way to make more money with their existing traffic. And we do that by powering a type of offer on the checkout page. If you think about your experience on an e-commerce store, you look around the product page. Oftentimes, you'll see cross-selling products you may also like. You'll see it on the category pages. You'll see it on the cart. We do that on the actual checkout page and right after the checkout page. And that's a pivot from what we used to do. And I'm happy to get into that.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. And we also have a wonderful episode with you, and you're well documented on the web. So I wanted to walk you through some topics
Cool. And
get your takes on them. And then perhaps we'll touch a little bit more on what Rally does.
Cool.
One of the things you've talked a lot about is you've shared some mixed thoughts about bootstrapping versus raising money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a topic we talk about a lot. I know next to nothing about raising money. I've always been just pretty basic. And I'm curious.
Real business?
I think it's a limitation of mine. I don't have any sort of sense for it. And I'm curious if you could bring us into that debate in your mind about, you know, when's the right time to raise money? What's it relevant for? And how does it compare to bootstrapping?
Sure. So maybe two things to start off. Number one, my motivation in either direction is to make as much money personally as possible. That's really the only after-tax money in your personal bank account is really the thing to optimize for. I think that's everyone's point of view, but most people either don't want to say it or it's shrouded between a few layers, you know, the public and the private, there's a few layers in between. The second thing is that I will say that I bootstrapped when I should have gotten funding and I got funding when I should have bootstrapped. So
walk us through that. That's really interesting.
It's just financing. It's just a tool, right? It's like, okay, you have a business idea. You want to get into business. You need to finance it somehow. You want to build a restaurant. You can either put all the cash in, you can take on some debt, or you can sell some equity, right? It's kind of like back to business school 101 kind of class. The difference is the market treats it very, very differently. And sometimes there are advantages in the arbitrage between the reality and how the market treats it. One of the stranger things that I experienced when raising money was like valuation has nothing to do with reality. And that's an interesting concept for a founder because you are conjuring value out of thin air, especially at the early stage. I was like you. I had only, you know, I did my family business, regular businesses, all bootstrapped, all like, don't look for VC. When I learned, I almost like forced myself. I wanted to learn how to do this, especially after Carthook and the bootstrapping experience. I was like, I think I'm ready for a different challenge. And it also made sense because I had just sold Carthook and I was in touch with VCs that were basically saying, if you want to raise money, you can. So one of the first weird lessons that told me, hey, this is perception more than reality at this early stage, is that your valuation is determined by how much you say you're going to raise. Because everything gets to work backwards. If at the seed stage, you're going to sell 15% or 20% of your company, if you raise $5 million at seed, then your valuation is 5x that. That's it. If you raise $3 million at seed, then your valuation is 3x at that. So that is interesting because you as the founder might own 30, 40, 50% of the company, and you just created. It's not real yet. It's in equity. It's not in cash. So that told me that there's a lot of leverage in learning how to play the game. And I think all of us saw certain people playing the game. And this is kind of where the hate comes from the bootstrap crowd, because you see people become astronomically rich and you're like, you didn't do anything yet. Your business isn't good. You're losing money. You know, it's a strange thing, but the market doesn't care. So I just found the whole thing very, very interesting. And I somewhat naively or arrogantly thought, hey, if I could build this business, Cardhook, with like 250 grand in the bank, what could I do with 15 million? Turns out this is not a direct correlation. But I was just really interested in firepower. It's just an interesting thing to be able to do a lot more, a lot faster, and have that be disconnected from reality, and reality being revenue.
I'm curious if you give us a sense for what it feels like to be at the helm of a capitalized company to that degree. There's some thinking that, okay, you know, there's investors and they like funnel down money into multiple places in a portfolio and they expect a few to hit, and then that makes the whole money system work. And then you compare that with some philosophies that say, well, having a capital constraint at the founder level actually makes a lot more sense because, you know, you have to like be more focused on product market fit. Do you have a sense about that now that you have like a big war chest? Does it change the way you behave in meaningful ways?
Yes. I think all of the maxims, all like the sayings or little truths that people hear or tell themselves, they're all true and they're all false. All at the same time. It's everything is specific. Some people are like, VCs are awful and they're vultures. I love my VCs. They're fantastic. Other people have different experience. Some people are like, you waste money. Yes, you do. So, you know, so do other people when they didn't raise money. So it's really dependent on who you raise money from and how you behave and your experience and so on. So like all like the general rules that people think of, I ignore because I just have not found any consistency in people's warnings or anything else.
That makes sense to me.
But I do behave very, very differently. This feels like my natural state.
Flush.
Flush. Yes. Yes. And okay, it brings up one thing that I end up thinking about or falling back on in these types of conversation. I think about, I grew up without money. I was born on a kibbutz in Israel, and my parents came over with no money when I was 6 years old. And then over time, my parents did better. But in my like formative childhood, I didn't have any money. And I think very often the venture version of business is better handled by people who grew up with money because they are free to take risk, more free to take risk. I played things pretty damn tight very often in my career because I was worried about running out of money.
Yeah.
And I kind of drag that mindset with me, and it took work to get through that. And I think, especially in the venture version of things, slow and steady and safe is not the point. The point is gigantic hit or nothing. And a big factor in our decision to pivot was we saw a path to just grind. But if you weigh that against like these years in your career, what is the point of grinding? You've committed to a certain version of things when you took money to begin with. Grinding and getting to profitability and slow growing, like that actually doesn't do anything for you. I got to hit the amount of money that we raised because everyone gets paid back first because they're preferred. And then on top of that, I get a percentage of that. If you're going slow and steady, what is the point? There's literally no point other than a salary, and none of us are really in this game for a salary.
Makes sense.
So high variance. Hit, bust, you know, one of those is better off. And if you like that version of things, then venture makes sense because you are taking other people's money and they're saying, not have fun, but now you can do this with someone else's money. You don't really have anything to lose. It is a partnership in risk. We will give you money. We want you to go crazy with this idea that you have that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
It is not build a nice, slow, steady business, pay people properly, build a team that loves each other. It's just different. Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think about how hard it is for me to turn money into money. You know what I mean? Just even the challenge of deploying that level of capital seems like a whole new world. I waste so much money at the small levels. I can I guess
if you disconnect emotionally from the money, you feel more free. So there is a level of responsibility. I don't waste investor money, right? Someone, either I read in a blog post or someone told me like how to handle, right? No one's watching. No one checks your statements. No one looks at your credit card. But the right mindset is if an investor looked at a line item in my credit card statement and said, what is that? I want zero shame whatsoever in telling them that is a Uber from LAX to here and I took the SUV and it cost $140 because of this reason. I need to feel good with that. So there is a level of responsibility and maturity required there. I've seen people not behave responsibly, which is not cool, but you should feel more free to spend. Here's an example. As we are pivoting and looking, what's this product going to do for us? What do we need to do next? One thought experiment that I have been running in my head is what if I took a pool of money and I put it off to the side, I put $250,000 and I said, I'm going to build a new product with this. In that situation, what would you do? If it's not your money and you're willing to lose it, what would you do with that $250K? I launched CardHub with like $10,000.
Yeah.
So what do you do with $250K? You can get a product built. You can buy a YouTube channel. You can market to them. You can spend $100,000 on advertising. And then you can see if it worked or not. And it is not an irresponsible thing to do if you're looking for high variance, you know, hit or bust.
Yeah.
And I would never do that with my own money. That's the reasonable.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're just able to speed up your feedback cycles. Essentially, ideally, that capital would bring you back information about the market faster.
Yes. And if you learn that in 30 days, instead of spending on salaries for 6 months, you actually saved an enormous amount of money.
That's the trick, is figuring out the point of information that matters. Because we get all this information about our business. I was thinking about this concept of like, how do you decide when to pivot? What level of information do you need to know how to pivot? Because I've really struggled with that. There's only a few more dollars and I'll have the information that I need, just another month of writing these checks. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, I will have the information that I need to know.
Yes. And what's the most dangerous version of that information is that it works a little bit.
Oh, it's the worst.
The worst. Because then you feel like you can't quit because it's clearly there's something there. And if it just was crickets, it would be easy to decide. And if it was a hit, it would be easy to decide. It's just that little bit. And then knowing whether to stop or not is like the worst curse. The thing I like to keep in mind is an interview with Noah Kagan a few years ago, where he said, everyone looks at my career and thinks everything I touch turns to gold. And in reality, it's because you only see the things that I stick with. And my bar is so high because I worked at Mint and Facebook that I know what real traction and real pull from the market feels like. And if I'm not feeling that, I'm not wasting my time. So I know of individual projects that Noah has done that have gotten traction that maybe you or I would look at and say, that's great, you got a business. And he goes, no thanks, it's not enough. It's not going to do what I want it to do. And so he drops it. And that feels like a matter of personal standards. And if there's anything I hate to look back on, it's that I sold myself short on something. You know, I didn't have the standards that I should have had. And so I'm going to try to bring that mindset forward into the next 12 months of demanding that my time should be spent on this thing. You have to add, you know, some ego into that to demand something very high.
There's this quote about product market fit from Brian at Reforged that animated me. He talked about the feeling of product market fit as a tailwind. And I'm curious if you had an example where you had a product idea and it was like good, but then it turned tailwind? Or is it something that we see early always? I'm confused a little bit by that because I always think of the cartoon with the miner in the tunnel and he's like a little bit away from gold. But he's like,
he quits right before.
He's been digging for so far. He quits right before. I wonder if quitting earlier ought to be a more default path.
I don't know. I haven't seen it enough to really know the difference.
Yeah.
That's the truth. So I have seen both. I've seen a variety of things. I've seen launch to crickets and it stay crickets and then drop it. I've also seen, hey, this kind of works. People are buying it, but I don't like the way the future looks. That's what CardHook started. The reason it's called CardHook is because it was an abandoned card app. So, I mean, I think you were like one of my first two or three customers.
No way.
Yes, dude.
I completely forgot about that.
A bar. What's it called? Portable bar?
Yeah.
That was like customer number three or something. Derek, that worked for you?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So that was going pretty well. We got it to about 20K in MRR. And then email service providers started adding abandoned carts as a feature. And I was like, we're dead. It's just a matter of time, which is why we pivoted to the checkout at CartHook. And the checkout was product market fit. The checkout was landing page, sign up form, and 100 people sign up in the first week. And we go, oh my God, we don't even have a product. So we should stop. And then tripling the price from $100 a month to $300 a month. And then demand just stayed exactly the same.
Incredible.
And then doing demos, and people on the demo would be like, I cannot believe what you built. Give me one sec. And then they would text their friend and they'd send the Zoom link to their friend, and their friend would join the Zoom and they'd be like, Bill, look at what these guys built. It was like, they didn't know what to do. They wanted it so bad. It was a really hard product to build. And that demand, that feeling is what pushed us through building a version two and then relaunching, all this pain. It was genuinely an enormous amount of pain. At some point we had something in the order of 120. Yeah, we had 400 trials a month for a $300 a month product. So it was $120,000 a month in MRR signing up and just churning like a washing machine. It was so painful, but eventually we built version two, and that's when it clicked. Then we stopped all the free trials. We said, no, you have to do a demo. It's going up to $500 a month, and we're adding 50 basis points to all the revenue on top of it, and we're changing that same pricing on our existing customers too. And people were like, don't care, fine, tell us whatever you want. So that's what that feels like.
That's what that feels like. That's that feeling that Brian's talking about. And it feels like the real version of that minor cartoon, which is you're often a couple clicks off. You know, if you're digging, like, it feels like if you're in the market, it's amazing how just a slight refactoring, if you taste a little bit of demand and you know there's need there, you're often a few clicks off. I think I see that story happen time and time again.
I think the adjustment to get it right, a few degrees off one or another, I think that's work that happens after the acknowledgement of demand. I think I have often given myself too much credit in the form of this one new feature, that's what's going to do it.
Oh yeah.
Adding this thing, that's what's going to do it. Partnering with this company, that's what's going to unlock. And in reality, if there wasn't strong demand for the most basic selling proposition that you put out there, I don't know if the adjustment a few clicks is actually going to unlock that. I think it's more, here's the basic key selling point, the pain that we're addressing, the desire that people, that one thing, that there's enough demand, and then the work begins. Then it's, should it be self-serve? Should it be this? What should the price be? What does the onboarding look like? Is there a virality element? Like, you know, all the work, actually.
That's actually where we miscalculated. It turns out that we were spending a ton of money building this fancy job board, and it is fancy. And I used it the other day and it was really cool. It felt like I was in a Starship Enterprise. I got like my data there and I was clicking through all these applications, like 350 applications, and it was fast and quick. And I was like, man, this is a nice piece of kit. But our clients would come to us and say, we hate using job boards. And you were one of those clients and you said, how about you just do the job board for me? And we were like, but we built this really quick job board, dude. And our clients were like, how about you do the job board for us? And that was our click. And then the recruiting business has been much more successful than our really fancy job board that we were always building these badass features. Every single week, they were so expensive, Jordan, to build these features.
Yeah. I think everyone listening can sympathize because we want to build, we want to create what we think the market needs, and the paying public just does not care. And I think the most successful entrepreneurs are either really good at ignoring their desires for around features and listening to customers, or really good intuition and really good understanding of what that type of customer wants and why. And then the freaks are the ones that just point out into the future and say, this is what people are going to want. And, you know, hallelujah.
Yeah, hallelujah to that. I mean, I often feel like demand is kind of duh for me. Like, it's such a simple thing that I look past it and I want to
complicate it with like my take on it or where I think it should go. Mm-hmm. I love this quote that no one else loves, so I'm just going to keep repeating it until it resonates with someone in the world. I remember there was like this video when John Mayer's first record came out, Room for Squares, and he had gone to Berklee College of Music, really fancy guitar player and stuff. And this jazz guitarist was like observing the line of youths waiting to see John Mayer play. And he was just like, John Mayer songs are just like, duh. He's just playing the song that everybody just wants to hear.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And it's like this jazz guitarist, of course, he can like decide the future of where the guitar should go.
The art.
But John Mayer could play that, but he's going to go up there and he's going to play Gravity or whatever, Daughters or, you know, and it's just duh. It's what people want.
Yes. I don't think I naturally have a sense of that. I think a lot of people, a lot of entrepreneurs, especially on the web, software, we're not mainstream. We think we're better than mainstream. We look down on mainstream and we miss gigantic pockets of demand because of it. We think we know better. And we think we have better taste. All these other things that go into feeding your superiority complex about how educated and smart you are and how good taste you have. And you end up not only looking down on mainstream point of view, we're also continuously baffled and enraged by people who farm engagement from the mainstream. It's a little bit like a Trump thing. You're like, how is this so popular? I think about Pink, the singer. It is just a set of cliches strung together. It's just one cliche after another, but it's huge. So it's a tough thing to set aside because in your normal life, you walk around, you're like, well, I know what kind of shirt to wear. I know what shoes are cool. And you miss the biggest audience.
Yep. There's a lot there. I really think this concept of feeling demand and maybe bringing your sophistication to how you serve it, but meeting it where it's at is a challenge. It is the challenge in a lot of ways. I wanted to talk to you about partnerships.
Okay.
It's something that Ian and I have been working on a lot in the past few years. And the one concept that came to me in our partnership is this concept of like a pervasive veto power. I'm not a dictator in my business because I always have to minister to a partner. And it requires a lot of maintenance. And if he disagrees with me, that holds me up. But if he agrees with me, now I've got a partner in crime. And ideally, our effort would be multiplicative. And so I'm wondering, I think so many people just jump into partnerships in the early days because they want to work with somebody on
something. Yeah, you don't want to do it alone.
But they're also the veto power and the most expensive thing that you'll ever do, potentially from a monetary perspective. And I know you've done this. And I'm curious as to what your sort of boilerplate advice would be for founders and what your perspective on partnerships in general is.
So I know myself and I need to be CEO. That's been since I was 10 years old. I just don't do well. You know what happens if I'm put in a situation where I'm not at the top of the decision-making? I work my way up to the top. And that's why I'm a bad employee, because I look around, I'm like, what? None of this makes any sense. And so I think knowing yourself and how you like to work and how you like to behave and how you like your day-to-day, I will take the trade-off of having the final say if it also means deciding to fire 10 people and getting on 10 Zoom calls and making people cry. And that sucks. So it is double-edged, and that's just the deal. Now, I have found success in partnerships where we both need each other. I am not technical. I don't know development. I don't know code. I don't know anything. I know enough to understand why things work. I don't know how to make it work. And so Rock and I have found a great partnership in him handling the technical and me handling the business side. And what that does is it provides natural veto over an area of expertise.
Yeah.
Right? It's a business decision. I get the last say. It's a technical decision. I might give an opinion, but it makes no sense for me to have the final say. So that, as much as possible, I think is good. I think the difficult thing, especially for younger entrepreneurs, myself included when I was younger, you have to be willing to be a gangster. You have to be able to make hard decisions sometimes. We call the CEO card, that concept of you don't want to pull the CEO card every week. You really shouldn't. at least in our situation, it's very collaborative. We have three people in the leadership team. We have myself and Rock and Jessica. We built Cardhook together. We then started Rally together. So we trust each other. Everyone has their own strengths and weaknesses and their areas of expertise. Everyone gets a different say and veto over different areas. And then every once in a while, you have to be willing to override. And so the way I view it is I put an enormous amount of social and political capital in the bank by always including, deferring, getting opinion. And then every once in a while, I'll spend what's in the bank and I'll say, totally hear you, understand you disagree, we're going to do what I say. So if it's rare and you leave it for important decisions, not these like little ego things on, well, I want it to be this color or that color, then you can be collaborative while still being able to say no, or it's going to be my way every once in a while. I'm a middle sibling. I'm a middle brother. So I'm not that surprised that this is kind of how I ended up managing, because that was my universe was, well, he can beat me up and I can knight him. And so how do I get both of these people to feel like they have exactly what they want and happy, but get what I want also? So I think that's all mixed in there.
What are some of the G things that you have to do, the gangster things that I think a lot of new founders are builders, they're creators, and then they reach a point where there's like this harder group of decisions to be made, especially around personnel.
Sure.
I'm wondering how you approach those things and how you frame them up to yourselves. Maybe you could bring us to some of the more difficult decisions you have to make as a CEO, and so that those of us listening along can ask ourselves if we're up to it.
The personnel is the hardest part. And I think that takes some building up of some scar tissue. And there's no way around that. But that is the single biggest mistake that I see less experienced people make. It's they don't fire people who need to be fired.
How do you do it? And why do you do it? It's similar to the, where do you draw the line and how do you draw the line? And then how do you express it to the other party?
So sometimes it's easy because it's obvious. We hired a salesperson recently, really good sales, really bad fit. And it was a few weeks in where it was obvious. And I lean on my team to be very honest about what's going on with other people around them. And I think that's really important, because as soon as you get a few layers in the company, right, we're not a big company, but there are three layers. There's the executive level, and then the management level, and then the individual contributor level in a few different departments, right? So let's say it's me talking to someone that runs go-to-market, and then they're talking to an SDR.
Yeah.
That's three layers. Little organization, but three layers. And the danger there, especially in a remote company, is that you just don't hear. And then what ends up happening is the person in the middle layer starts to feel guilty because they're not happy, but they feel bad. They don't want to come to you. So the first thing is an environment of transparency. And what I try to drill into people is that if someone's not a good fit, that doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means they're not a good fit. And it's better for the company and for them that they go elsewhere. And the people around them deserve that management knows that this person isn't a fit. So instead of, I try to take the guilt away and say, this isn't you ratting on someone.
Yeah.
It's you saying, hey, my standards are really high and this is not working for us for these reasons. And you need to know about that, boss. So I think that's hugely important, because that helps you understand when someone needs to be let go before it gets really bad and damages other people around them. So just that information to begin with. And then once you have that information, the amount of time between getting that information and making the decision should be minimal. So if I hear something and then a week later I hear something else and then I check in with someone else, the next day the person's gone.
Could you walk us through that? Because I think there's a lot of people listening who feel that they might need to make that decision and they're maybe dragging their feet on it. How do you go about maybe the simple approach?
Like practically?
Yeah, practically.
Sure. Practically, you talk with, if there's a manager involved and you don't want to skip over them because that sucks. So you want them involved in it. So let's just say in that scenario, myself talking to go-to-market person and we're letting go of an SDR. So first I will talk with the go-to-market manager and I will let them know, okay, I've decided this needs to end and we're going to do it tomorrow at 9 a.m. So then we get the technical team involved. We use JumpCloud. And Jump Cloud gives you control over access to systems, including laptop. And so the first thing we do is make sure the technical team knows that we're going to let this person go at 9 a.m. And then they're at the ready. And then we invite the person to a Zoom. And then as soon as that person comes on the Zoom, then I let the technical team know we're talking to them. And then the conversation is very, very short and very, very to the point. Hi, your name. Unfortunately, this is not going to be a good conversation. Today's going to be your last day at the company. I want to thank you very much for your contributions and everything that you've done here. Unfortunately, we've made the decision to let you go today. After this meeting, you'll get an email from me with all the information, including about health insurance. You'll also receive a severance and release agreement from me. And as soon as you sign that, we'll be able to release your severance of whatever the policy is. Thank you so much. If there's anything that you need after this call, you'll be cut off from all of the systems, including Slack and the laptop and your email. If you do need to get back into that, please just let me know and we'll let you back in. I hope you understand it's for security reasons. After that, we'll send you a box for you to return your laptop. Thank you so much. I wish you nothing but the best. It's when it turns from this friendly relationship that we want it to be during work. And then at some point, you're a manager and you are representing the company and you need to deliver that message in a very straightforward way. And you don't leave room for questions because the decision's already been made. So it's not about, hey, can you know, what if I fix this or what if I fix that? That's kind of done. And the best line to use there if someone comes back is, I understand, but the decision has been made.
I'm really glad you shared that with us because...
Are you?
Yeah, thanks for doing that. I don't know if you have any traumatic
stress. People had to fire people.
No, it's interesting because just knowing how you go through those reps and build up that scar tissue, as you say, like, it helps you to do the hard thing that moves businesses forward. And I actually see that as a real gap between, like you said, experienced founders and ones who are having trouble growing their businesses is team composition will change. And you're the G. You're in charge of that. And one of the things about your process that's interesting is when people are not succeeding at a company, they typically will be, it's like buying a boat and selling a boat. You know, it's the best 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
When they got hired and when they get fired, they tend to be very compelling. And so shutting the door immediately, it's not a conversation. I'm curious, when people ask for feedback, they say, okay, Jordan, I took 2 months of my life to come work at your company. I would like to know how to improve. You're just kicking me out of the company. Do you offer them notes if they ask in that manner?
Yes, but I separate it out from what's happening that day. So I say, what I have found is that feedback is best delivered outside of this very emotional moment. And so after this, we'll kind of do what we need to do. We'll do legal. We'll make sure everything is buttoned up. And then I'm happy to talk to you after that. And I'm happy to give recommendations and be very honest about your strengths.
Pro.
So I just separate it out because it's hard. It's an emotional thing. It's difficult. It's money. It's livelihood. It's fucking stressful. And you got to respect that. And everything I said maybe felt a bit cold because I'm not actually firing you and you didn't just work for me for 18 months. Yeah. In a normal setting, it's genuinely heartfelt because I appreciate the hell out of the person and it sucks that I have to let them go. And it should be acknowledged and treated as this thing that is not good and it needs to be taken seriously and thoughtfully.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I appreciate that. Jordan, one of the things you used to talk about all the time was crypto.
Yeah.
And I, like you, found myself really caught up in this wave in 21 when I had so many friends who quit their business to go full-time on crypto. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking about how to get involved ourselves, whether we should tokenize our community, mm-hmm. whether or not we should find ways to get involved. And now I see crypto at an all-time high as we're recording this mm-hmm. and not a peep on the Twitters about this. What is your take? I mean, it was mayhem the last time we were at the top, and here we are, and it's quiet.
I don't know about the quiet part. I don't know what did it, the environment, what's happening in the zeitgeist, people paying attention to war and not the other stuff. I think 2021 also, every single topic became heightened because the attention was exponentialed. It was multiplied by everyone just staring online all the time. And that was the majority of people's lives and attention, other than COVID and hanging out at home. I think it was also novel, right? It was new a few years ago, at least to the mainstream public, right? It's been around for longer than that, but something about the last one kind of captured people's attention and imagination. And now it's a little bit of, it's easier to roll your eyes at it because you've seen it before. So I don't know what it is that makes it quiet. I'm frustrated about crypto because it feels obvious to me that it makes sense. And yet there's so much in the way in terms of regulation. Well, it's both. It's not just regulation. It's also people have to believe and they have to be open-minded. I think it's obvious that it's the greatest way to put capital together ever.
Why is that? Why do you think that?
Because it takes the concept of an IPO, which is distributed ownership, and it makes it global and instantaneous and liquid.
It allows you to capitalize things quickly, ideally.
It's the greatest way to form capital ever. And when I saw that, I thought it made sense to go toward it. We ended up raising VC for Rally, but in my docs in VC, with our investors, you know, we have the right to tokenize because I thought that's where companies were going to go. It feels very strange to have a mechanism for forming capital and generating liquidity, and it's just not be used because people don't want to believe in it. It's pretty weird. But right now, the tech exists to be able to raise your hand and say, I'm forming a business. Here's me. Here's my background. Here's the business. I'm going to raise $20 million from unaccredited investors throughout the entire world. Has nothing to do with restricted markets in terms of borders.
Yep.
And then we will decide what makes sense for our tokens and our ownership on when you can get liquid. But along the way, as the company grows and the market decides the value of your company, people can exit and enter like it's a public company. Seems obvious to me that that's beneficial. But if it's not going to happen, then fine. I can't make it happen myself. So I got to adjust.
There was a lot of optimism that I heard on your pod about building for that future. And what's standing in the way of it? What do you think are the key barriers for us on our side? I went down the rabbit hole of tokenizing our community and it just feels like it's a lift now. And maybe let's just get those US dollars until something changes.
Yes. And we came to the same conclusion, right? The original vision of Rally was to build a checkout that was open to the web. And what that means is you can build your store anywhere, you can build your business, you can do whatever you want. But if you send your payments to be processed through this checkout, we will give you a portion of ownership in the checkout itself. So it becomes like a checkout that lives on the internet that's owned by the people, by the merchants that send payments through it. It's as if Shopify started and said, if you're a merchant on Shopify, you will earn a piece of Shopify ownership based on how much revenue you process through our checkout. I had enough conviction in that and like emotional attachment to wanting that to happen that I went out and raised $18 million and built a team and built a product and did it. But the market didn't want it that way. So who cares what I want? It's just what it is.
What are you going to do with the $18 million?
So about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, we came to the conclusion that all boulders are hard to push up the hill. Right? Startups, business, it's going to be hard. But there does come a point in time where you should stop pushing and maybe find a different boulder. So about 2 months ago, we came to the conclusion of, you know what? This isn't going to work. The internet doesn't want it in this way. The e-commerce market outside of Shopify is in very bad shape. And there's no business here right now. And so we need to adjust. And so we put that product aside and we pivoted to a different product that I just explained at the beginning.
And your whole website's changed.
Oh, yeah.
It's super simple when you go to,
yep,
to your website, what you guys offer.
Yes.
Or a part of it. You're showing the tip of the spear.
Right. The interesting part of the experience is that the checkout I had emotional attachment to. I wanted that to happen. I built a checkout company prior to this called Cardhook. It grew. We did almost $4 billion in processing. We got it to 6 million ARR, doubling every year. Amazing company, profitable. And then Shopify killed it. And that sucks. That'll sting. That stays with you. And that was part of my revenge fuel for going out and raising a bunch of money and like building this new version of an e-commerce platform that didn't do what Shopify does to its community. All right. So that's like ideological, emotional, all this attachment. Once we came to the conclusion of, all right, cool idea and all, but the market doesn't want it right now. Once we did that, now I feel untethered. Maybe untethered has like a negative connotation, but I feel free. I can do whatever I want now. So the product that we're running with right now, I'm viewing maybe a bit skeptically. I want the product to prove to me that I should spend the next 5 years on it.
Jordan, a lot of our listeners aren't in e-commerce, but we serve e-commerce founders as a part of our portfolio. Can you give us the overview? Tell us a little bit about how and why Shopify shut down or intruded on Carthook's business. And then give us a 101, what's going on in e-commerce from your perspective right now?
Okay. I want to caveat this by saying I have a very specific point of view based on my experience. So take it with a grain of salt. This is the Jordan Gall view of what's happening in e-commerce.
That's what we came here for.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So just to touch on why Shopify kind of, crushed Carthook, it's because we did payment processing. We offered people a checkout that had a bunch of features that Shopify couldn't handle at the time. And people really wanted it because it was very effective in making people pay more money. The issue is that we did the payment processing. And the payment processing is where the power is in e-commerce. And so Shopify is really a payment processing company. It's a checkout company with a front end and an app ecosystem. That's my view of what Shopify is. I think I have been proven right if you look at the annual filings or quarterly filings of Shopify as a public company. The percentage of revenue generated from payment processing services crossed over the 50% mark a few years ago. And I think at the latest filing, it was something like 76% of the revenue. So they make their money on payment processing. And our little 15-person company that raised a few $100,000 from friends and family that was doing $1 billion a year in processing, they just couldn't let that stand.
How did they communicate to you?
Oh, screw them on the communication. We were effectively poking them in the business model. And if you look around the Shopify ecosystem, they have built an unbelievably good ecosystem. There are not many places better on the web to go off and start a bootstrap company than the Shopify App Store, right? That is the truth. How do they communicate? I don't want to get too far into the story, but not nicely. They tortured us on the way to death. It worked out at the end of the day for us overall. It didn't work out as well as it should have, considering how we were growing and the money that we were making. But we made money, and I ended up selling the company after pivoting to something more acceptable to Carthook. And then it allowed me to take my credibility and raise money for Rally. What I see happening in e-commerce overall is that Shopify will continue to eat market share from the other e-commerce platforms.
Why?
Because it's better. It is not just better, it's a lot better. And you also have the combination of it being better, and the market right now wants cost savings. And Shopify offers that. As a Shopify Plus merchant, if you're on Salesforce Commerce Cloud right now, you are spending far more money than you would if you were on Shopify. And so they got the tailwind of the economic conditions and the execution of the product with the agencies that are incentivized to bring people over and the amazing app store. They're just going to continue to crush. And that is awesome for Shopify and Shopify shareholders. It is questionable on how good that is for the app ecosystem, because it's a bit of a product of its own success. It's so much opportunity for app developers and in a clearly defined API space that what is happening now is the competition is severe. And because of that, it's hard to build a breakout. So there are some legacy apps, Recharge, PostScript, Klaviyo, and a handful of others that are hit escape velocity and will continue to do well as the leader in their space. But right now, it's a great place to build a company from $1 to $3 million a year kind of thing. It is a horrible place to build a $100 million a year company.
And it's because it's like the tall poppy thing, like developers from all around the planet are going to take a chunk out of you once you assert yourself.
Anything that works will get copied, commoditized, undercut on price, matched in features. It's an efficient market in a small API design space. So Shopify is relatively restricted in what you can and can't do. And because of that, all the apps have the same features, and then they compete on price, and they compete on like the Twitter contest of who's cooler and who knows who and who's bribing this agency that doesn't know it. And this thing, it's just what it is right now.
So there's these curves of opportunity, and it's leveling and sort of on the back. Similar, like I think about FBA, if you heard about that in the right year, it was game on.
Yeah.
And now's the wrong time to hear about FBA.
Yeah, that's kind of happening in other places. The web is just built out. It's pretty mature at this point, and competition is what it is. It's very high. You got a bunch of really smart, ambitious people all competing. all at the same time. And e-commerce outside of Shopify is unhealthy, I would call it.
Let us know a little bit about that.
Sure.
I can think of off the top of my head, a lot of people that listen to this show that have an agency and a lot of their clients are on Shopify and they want to pick up more e-commerce clients. Let us know a little bit about what's going on in the e-commerce space.
So we have been selling to e-commerce merchants outside of Shopify for the past 2 years or so. And you have smaller ecosystems that don't operate the same way. So Shopify, you kind of understand what the playbook looks like. You get a few merchants, you use that credibility, you build case studies, you parlay that into larger merchants, then you tell everyone about how amazing the performance is for those large merchants. Maybe you give some of those merchants a little piece of the company. Everyone kind of like creates this FOMO and energy and momentum by pointing to the success of other merchants, and you claw your way to getting those first few merchants, then you get reviews, and it's like this relatively understood playbook. And the Shopify ecosystem, you can kind of like wrap your hands around. You know where a bunch of them are.
Yeah.
You go onto Twitter, you see who the influencers are. It's like a relatively well-defined. The second you step out of that, it's much more nebulous. So the big commerce ecosystem is kind of tough to tell like which merchants you actually want to go after. It's a lot of long tail, a lot of merchants that are not great, you know, sub-million. And then the Salesforce Commerce Cloud is very confused. It's larger merchants, so it's tough to get to the decision maker. And so you got to do outbound sales. You got to do a multi-step sales process. You got to wine and dine. You got to go to events. And that's just a different thing. Magento, there's like a ton of merchants doing like $25 to $50 million a year, but good luck finding them.
Yeah.
Tricky to find. And then you got Commerce Tools, and that is its own thing. And then the agencies that are servicing all those merchants are struggling and trying to figure out how to get recurring revenue through services because no one's doing new site builds. No one's dropping $400,000 on a new site. And the word has gone out in all the merchants to cut expenses. So going to that type of a merchant saying, hey, if you use my software, it's going to cost you $50,000 this year, but it's going to make you $500,000. Cool story, bro. But my boss told me to cut expenses.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's not their company. And for me, I think that was the single biggest factor in all of it. When I sold to Shopify merchants, it's business owner to business owner. I happen to run a software company. You happen to run an e-commerce brand, but we're making decisions that are rational for a business owner to make.
Yeah.
The second you talk to employee one out of 150, that's four levels removed from even giving a crap about how the company does and they care about their job, it's a different conversation entirely.
Got you. That makes sense. Well, one final thing. I wanted to ask you about having a family.
Okay.
So something I've heard you talk about, and I'm going to be a first-time father in 4 weeks.
No way. So congrats.
I'm right on the doorstep. And I'm curious if you have any top-level thoughts about how having a family impacts your business career and what are some things that I can anticipate, both on the positive and negative side?
Oh, boy. So I've been a dad for 12 years. I have three daughters, ages 7, 9, and 12. I find it just a lot of fun. And it helps with my motivation, for sure. I like the added reason to do well. It makes me feel like I am pursuing the right goals and I have the right dreams. The Lambo bottles at the club, and like that young version of thing that you see on Instagram, I don't think that makes you happy. So it makes me feel very comfortable as I'm driving my daughter last night home from her dance class with her two friends, and they're yapping in the back and laughing and having, I feel like I'm on the right track because I see happiness and fulfillment as I wouldn't trade my life. I don't want another version of my life. So kids help you do that because you look at the kids and you say, I've gone to a good place and my kids are happy. And that makes me feel very satisfied. And what that helps me do is be patient and methodical on the business front because it's worth the work.
Yeah.
It's worth the years of effort. And it doesn't feel thin and empty because it's not for me and for fancy cars. It's for something bigger. And that feels worth it. So I love it. I end up stopping 5:30 or so, and I go down to cook dinner, and I put music on, I hang with the kids. And then I'll usually go back to the laptop in bed later for an hour or two. So I don't really see any issues around time. I rarely find that time is really an issue. It's more discipline and focus and finding some productivity. It's not the amount of time I spend. So I don't see any downside. And it's an enormous amount of satisfaction and motivation and stress. The bar goes way up. The requirement for success. I have three kids. What college is going to cost? You really need a lot more money than you thought you needed. That's a reality. Like back 10 years ago, and I was like, oh, a few million bucks is, you know, would be amazing. Now it's like, bro, you got to make a lot of money. No joke. And I don't want to work until I'm 70. So it does focus the mind.
I love it.
That's a great way to end it. Jordan, what a pleasure stopping by the podcast. Your podcast is Bootstrapped Web. It's a banger every week. Thank you for joining us on the TMBA podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tropical MBA podcast. You can go to tropicalmba.com, get access to hundreds of back episodes and all kinds of other goodies. Load up your iPod. That is the cheapest way to fly business class on your next international flight. We will see you next Thursday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.